The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Classified documents have been discovered in former Vice President Mike Pence's Indiana home. The Department of Justice sues Google to try to break up its monopoly over the advertising business. The United States and Germany send war tanks to Ukraine. And I interview Thomas Baker, former FBI agent and author of the recently released book, The Fall of the FBI. I'm Julie Hartman, and this is Timeless. Welcome, friends. It is Thursday, January 26th, 2023, and here is the news that you need to know today. First, a few classified materials were discovered at former Vice President Mike Pence's Indiana home, according to a January 18th letter sent by the National Archives. After seeing the news that classified documents were discovered at President Biden's home and think tank, Mr. Pence asked his personal lawyers to conduct a search of his files, and the lawyers then found, quote, a small number of classified documents bearing classified markings that were inadvertently boxed and transported to the personal home of the former vice president at the end of the last administration. The documents have since been handed over to the FBI, and our Attorney General Merrick Garland will announce the next steps. The question that I have about this story, as well as the Biden and Trump classified document stories, is what is the system of keeping track of these classified materials? We know that government officials are only allowed to look at classified documents in sensitive compartmented information facilities, the acronym is SCIFS, which are all over the place. And there's actually one in the White House, which is the White House Situation Room. But how does it happen that these officials leave with the documents? In an era of barcoding, like we have at public libraries or at a grocery store where you can check things out or check them back in, why aren't these documents being barcoded? Why don't they have a system in place where, for instance, if Trump was looking at a document, they could scan the document out, essentially, to indicate that Trump was looking at it. And then when he returned it, they could scan the document in. So that way they know that if a document is missing according to their database inventory. Also, another question I have is, did our government officials or the people in charge of these classified documents even know that there were certain documents missing in the first place? We need to get a lot more answers about the protocol and the security systems that our government has to protect these materials that are so vital to our national security. In other domestic news, the Department of Justice is suing Google to try to break up Google's monopoly over brokers, suppliers, and online auctioneers of advertisements placed on websites. As some of us know, we here in the United States have antitrust laws, which not all countries have, and certainly not as much as we have them. Antitrust laws started back in the late 19th century when John D. Rockefeller, the oil tycoon, used to control the entire oil industry in the United States. With the passing of the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890 and other antitrust laws, the United States government held that we do not want one or even two companies controlling an entire industry. They wanted to allow a competitive market. And these laws set rules against things like predatory pricing, where a company will lower their prices of their product to drive out competitors. And then once those competitors are gone, they raise the prices again. And they also outlawed other practices like collusion with other companies to set a price limit. The Department of Justice is alleging that Google controls too much of the online advertising business through its 2008 purchase of the ad-serving company DoubleClick. Google, among other things, punishes consumers and businesses that do not use DoubleClick. In the past 40 to 50 years, our antitrust laws, interestingly, have had very little enforcement. They reached their height at the end of the 19th century and throughout the 20th century, but they cooled off in recent decades, thanks to, in part, the influence of Professor Robert Bork, who was a law professor at Yale. And he was famously nominated to the Supreme Court in the late 1980s, only to be borked or blocked from getting that Supreme Court seat. And he famously argued in one of his books that the antitrust laws in this country had become too concerned with breaking up business monopolies. And Bork said that the problem with this is that a lot of times what this does is it keeps inefficient, backward-looking, uninnovative businesses alive. The problem with our antitrust laws is that it's too focused on having multiple participants in the market. And sometimes, Bork argued, the reason why businesses have a monopoly in the market or get a lot of market power is because consumers are rewarding a well-run, efficient business. So we will see how this lawsuit pans out with Google, and we will continue to update you as developments arise. And finally, out of respect to our interviewer, I'm not going to give a detailed analysis on this news story, but I promise you I will in the coming days. President Biden has announced that the United States is going to send 31 M1 Abrams tanks, that's named after General Abrams of the Vietnam War. Those are battle tanks or tanks with big guns on them, to Ukraine. Germany is also joining us by sending 14 Leopard 2 tanks to Ukraine as well. And again, I will get more into the analysis of this in coming days. But a question I want to preliminarily, if that is even a word, ask you is, what is the exact strategic use for these tanks? Obviously, many Americans want to help Ukraine, but I think one of the lessons that we learned from Afghanistan, where we handed over $85 billion of weaponry that only ended up in the hands of the Taliban, is that we have to be really smart and careful when we lend other countries weapons. So we will discuss more of that in the coming days. We all know that the FBI has been in the news a lot lately as a result of the Twitter files, which exposed the FBI's corruption and collusion with big tech. Here to talk with me about the FBI is Mr. Thomas Baker. He was an FBI special agent for 33 years, and he served as a management instructor at the FBI Academy in Quantico, Virginia. He's the author of a recently released book called The Fall of the FBI, How a Once Great Agency Became a Threat to Democracy. I encourage you all to order it. It is a page-turner. So to start off, Tom, I want to ask you, I'm making the assumption that you are not related to James Baker, who is the former FBI general counsel and the one who was personally responsible during his time at Twitter for quashing the Hunter Biden story.
Absolutely no relation.
Do you get asked that a lot?
But once before I was, actually, and thank you for clarifying it.
Right. Well, I read that you started off at the FBI in the year 1967, which was obviously the year before Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination. Did you have involvement in that case at all, investigating his assassination?
Oh. Well, indirectly, I was in, and that this is in fact a chapter in the book, in my book, The Fall of the FBI. I was assigned in Jacksonville, Florida. Martin Luther King was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee, and there was an immediate reaction all over the nation, really, but particularly in the Southeast, in trying to apprehend the shooter. And then in Jacksonville, we had a situation where Martin Luther King's only brother happened to be at the time, and he organized a mourners march. So the country was in a high state of alert. You may recall, it's in all the history books, there was riots in the Capitol in Washington, D.C., and in several other American cities. About 18 people were killed in Washington, and the riots got close to the White House. So the National Command Authority at that point, they wanted all demonstrations covered. And the point I make in my book, looking forward to the current day, is that in the 1960s and into the 70s, we didn't have the guidelines we have today in the FBI. So a lot of things were really not quite too clear. And when they said cover the demonstration, we puzzled ourselves. What were we to do? Are we there to just observe? Are we there to prevent civil rights violations? What is our role to be? And it was ambiguous.
Mm-hmm.
Following on the Mourners March, we got word in our office that the Ku Klux Klan was having a march, and I recount that. So I was with the fellows who were monitoring the Ku Klux Klan march, we realized, looking back on it, how lucky we were in the succeeding years after the 70s and the 80s and the 90s to have guidelines where we knew what we were doing and why we were doing it. It's kind of an exciting chapter because there's a little violence involved in it.
So, Tom, what made you want to join the FBI in the 60s, and what was the recruiting and training process like?
Well, what made me want to join, I it was a boyish or romantic idea. My grandfather had been a policeman in the city of Brooklyn, New York, when it was its own city, and his two sons, my uncles, my maternal uncles, had both been policemen in New York City. And as a small boy, and then even as a teenager, I heard their stories, their adventures, and that kind of fed my passion for law enforcement. There's, once again, a chapter in the book about this. But long story short, I joined the FBI in a support capacity. I worked in the photo lab in New York City for a year or two before I found an opening and was granted an opening to new agents training. In those days, the bulk of new FBI agents were recent law school graduates, but they did sprinkle in a few more quote-unquote working-class kids like myself on occasion, and that's how I managed to get in.
And then once you were in, I know you do talk about this in your book, and I promise you I did read it, but I'm trying to ask you these questions so that the audience can hear if they didn't read the book. Can you describe what the training process was like once you were in? I had a CIA agent here on the show a few weeks ago named Andrew Bustamante, and he told me that as part of the CIA recruiting process, they obviously put you through a lot of arduous physical tasks and challenges. But also, he said a big component of the training was writing essays. Learning a lot about United States foreign policy. Was there also that component in the FBI of writing and those lessons?
Well, I went there, and that was all down in Washington, of course, just before the quote unquote new FBI academy opened at Quantico, which is rather modernistic, self-contained academic campus. And just before the Hoover building, the J. Edgar Hoover building, was open for business, it was under construction. So at that time, FBI headquarters was still within the Justice Building on Pennsylvania Avenue, a massive building. And there's a classroom on the fifth or sixth floor of that building where we had almost all our classes. And the only time we departed from there was a few days at a time. We went to the Marine base at Quantico, where we use the firearms ranges, and that's where we had our firearms training. But almost all the training was in that classroom in Washington, D.C. It was quite a historic classroom. We were told right away, and I've since read about this numerous times, it's where during World War II, the Nazi saboteurs who were caught after they came in off submarines were tried by a military tribunal. And the classroom was also used in the movie The FBI Story, in several scenes where Jimmy Stewart was the star of that movie. Mm.
So can you give us a brief primer on how the FBI is organized? My understanding is that there are these field offices around the country, and then obviously there's the training facility that you worked at in Quantico, Virginia, and then there's the J. Edgar Hoover building in D.C., which is the FBI headquarters. So how do the field offices work with the headquarters in Washington? Do they kind of have their own authority in those respective offices, or is the power more so centralized in Washington?
Well, for about 75 years, the FBI was very field-orientated. The cases were run out of the field. There were a field agent, investigator had the case. He had a field supervisor standing over him, reviewing his work. Then there was the agent in charge of that field office. And ultimately, headquarters had oversight you might say program management. That worked very well because it provided levels of review and levels of independent judgment. Things kind of went off the track when Mueller became director after September 11th. He centralized the management of the investigation of the September 11th case in headquarters. And then that model was followed through by Comey and the Hillary Clinton email investigation and the Russian collusion investigation. So what you had then was, with this headquarters management, you had a few people at headquarters doing everything. And you've heard the names of Peter Strzok and McCabe. They made the decisions what way the investigation was to go, and then they went and did it. They actually went and conducted the interviews themselves, so they didn't have the layers of review. And that's one of the key and very identifiable instances where the FBI has gone off track.
Right. I'm glad that you brought up Robert Mueller, because you write in your book that he was primarily responsible for turning the FBI into primarily an intelligence agency as opposed to a law enforcement agency. Do you think that any of that would have happened without 9/11?
I don't know. That would be speculation. But what did happen was, and I recounted in the book, and I've heard about this firsthand from Robert Mueller himself several times, and I read the other people's accounts of this meeting. He was named the FBI director literally about 4 or 5 days. He became the FBI director 4 or 5 days before the September 11th attacks, which happened on a Tuesday. And on that following Saturday, September 15th, President George W. Bush was at his retreat with his immediate circle. As you can imagine, it was 3.5 days after this attack in the mountains in Maryland, Camp David. And Mueller showed up to brief him on the FBI's investigation. Now, at that point, Mueller had only been director about a week, mm-hmm. and he had the FBI report with him. And he was very pleased to be, in a sense, to be able to present the report, because in 3.5 days between the Tuesday and that Saturday morning, the FBI had done what it does best, investigate. And they had identified all 19 hijackers. They had identified their contacts, their financing, their associations, their past travel, and their connections all the way back to Al-Qaeda. When he was done presenting this report, George W. Bush said to him, "I don't care about that. I just want to know how you're going to prevent the next one." Later that morning, George Tenet, then the director of the CIA, presented a plan of action going forward. When Tenet was done speaking, George W. Bush said to him, "That's great." And then he turned and faced Mueller and said, "That's what I want to hear," pointing back to Tenet. Mueller was humiliated, and he vowed after that meeting that he was going to change the culture of the FBI away from a law enforcement organization to an intelligence-driven agency. Now, there may have been good reasons, or apparently good reasons at that moment, but that change had a lot of unintended and very negative consequences.
What were those consequences?
Well, the consequences were they all had their basis back in the different nature, the different culture between a law enforcement entity and an intelligence entity. When you're in a law enforcement organization, consciously or unconsciously, every day you live exists for the ultimate day when you're going to have to stand up in court before a judge, before a jury, before a grand jury, and raise your right hand and swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And that's what ultimately you deal with in law enforcement, the truth and facts. In an intelligence agency, it's a whole different culture. They deal every day, they live through deception and deceit, and their end product is an estimate. They call it an intelligence estimate. We would call it best guesses, and guesses aren't allowed in the courtroom. And they work outside the Constitution. They work outside a legal framework. It creates a whole different mindset. And in making that switch and bringing up leaders in that dynamic, I believe, is a main contributor to all the problems the FBI has had in the last 3 or 4 years.
Do you think that those two functions, that is law enforcement and intelligence, should be separated into two separate agencies instead of just concentrated in the FBI?
No, but I will say this. For years, myself and many others, when we would lecture public groups or respond to questions, we would always point out the uniqueness of that the United States of America has in that our domestic intelligence service is a law enforcement agency, so it is forced to work within the parameters of the law. Now, that's not the case in other countries around the world, and even in other Western countries like Canada or elsewhere. They have this separate function, so they have a domestic intelligence agency that's working beyond the parameters of the law. They're not working in those guidelines. Creates a different dynamic. Unfortunately, with the primacy that Mueller and then Comey put on this intelligence-driven mindset, I fear instead of being blessed at having a law enforcement agency as a domestic intelligence service, we may be cursed to have a domestic intelligence service with police powers. And that's why the subtitle of my book is How the FBI is Becoming a Threat to Democracy Rather Than a Guardian of Democracy.
So can you please explain how deep the political influence goes? Your explanation about the FBI sort of transforming into more of an intelligence agency makes sense as to why it's become more politicized, because if it's spying and going after American citizens, that kind of does go hand in hand with politicization. But how deep does it go? Is it just sort of concentrated at the top levels, or is it the FBI thoroughly infiltrated?
Well, it's definitely at the top level, and we've seen some terrific examples of it lately. And shockingly, a few days ago, an SAC from New York in charge of counterintelligence has actually been arrested for collaborating with foreign agents. So it is at the top. I fear the mentality, the people being developed today, what one thing that is happening is, and you mentioned in your introduction, the Twitter files thing. They're so absorbed in these distinctions of domestic terrorism, domestic extremism, people putting out misinformation, that they don't see sometimes how others of us see. And when I say others, I'm including not only the general public, but the population of former agents who grew up under the old rubrics. They don't see how we perceive this to be a threat to free speech. I had a very interesting conversation just 2 weeks ago with a young woman who's an intelligence analyst at the current FBI. And she just couldn't see this, where what we see, that in telling Twitter to ban or shadow ban certain people's opinions, that you're interfering with the free speech of American citizens. They just don't get it. They have to lift up their head and look at the big picture. I think that's one of the problems. It is spreading through the ranks.
It's been commonly said that the FBI is so corrupt that you would have to abolish it and start a new organization. Do you agree with that statement, or do you think that it is salvageable?
I pray and hope that it's salvageable. What my book calls for is the reform of the culture. And culture can be changed. And there's textbooks written about how they change culture in corporate life. But to change culture, you have to first recognize the problem and want to do it. And several FBI leaders recently, including Director Wray, they don't seem to recognize a problem. Every time something bad happens, and we can go back through this fellow who was arrested 2 days ago and go back all the way to Comey, McCabe, and Strzok, who were all fired. The two agents who were fired who were involved in the gymnast case, two agents who were fired who were involved in the fiasco of the Governor Whitmer kidnapping plot. Every time one of these things happens, the director says, well, the bad apples are gone. The miscreants have been dismissed. They're no longer with us. And what they have to do is stop saying that and look at the underlying cause, that there's a culture, a problem underneath it that has to be reformed, that has to be changed.
Again, I know that you point to Robert Mueller as the progenitor of some of these changes, but when do you think the FBI really became the politicized force that it is today? Roughly what year or under which director would you associate
with
that?
It started with the cultural change that Mueller enforced, and Mueller was there for 12 years. And then it was exacerbated by the poor leadership of Comey, who floated above it all, and all these people who rose up under Mueller really ran the ship. The other thing that's missing now is, and I think as part of changing the culture, they have to restore the respect and the primacy of the Constitution in training and in retraining and in daily activities of the FBI.
Can you be more specific about how they would do that? Because, you know, obviously the Constitution doesn't call for the existence of an FBI, though I can gather that you're talking about our principles and the Bill of Rights being applied to the agent's conduct.
Exactly, the Bill of Rights. And in an earlier question, you asked me about training. And back in those days, the training outside the classroom was, as I said, firearms training and things like that. But in that classroom, most of the training was devoted to the Constitution for 3 months.
Wow.
We had agent instructors who were attorneys, and most of my classmates were recent law school graduates. But we were taught about the Constitution, specifically the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments. And I remember, and I've told this story to people who are defense attorneys, they can't believe this, but there was such a reverence for the Constitution. Our instructors told us that we should not see the Bill of Rights, particularly the Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendments, as obstacles to getting our job done. We should embrace it, and that we were there, part of our role was to protect the Bill of Rights. And one instructor even gave us, when we finished, a pocket copy of the Constitution, and he told us to always keep it with us in our breast pocket. And he said, when you're at an interview of a citizen, when you're searching someone's home, you'll remember you have that Constitution in your pocket, and it's very unlikely that you'll ever do wrong or go off the track. That's the reverence we had for the Constitution, and that's what needs to be restored. And this Twitter thing is an example of that. How they could in anyone step back and look at the situation where you have the FBI, who as part of the federal government is forbidden by the Constitution from curtailing free speech. That's the First Amendment. But yet they have a commercial entity, Twitter, censoring the speech of American citizens. It's so clear a violation of the spirit of the Constitution, but a lot of them can't see it today. And that's why we got to return to retraining on the Constitution and reemphasizing the constitutional guidelines. That takes primacy. And one of the arguments I've gotten pushed back on from some people in today's FBI, well, it'll make our job harder, you know, if we don't censor this speech. Well, the whole Bill of Rights makes the job of government harder. It's something we just have to live with.
Right. The point is doing the right thing, you know, whether or not it's easy or hard. That's really amazing that they gave you that pocketbook copy of the Constitution. I can imagine that they do not do that today in the FBI. I want to ask you about your opinion of J. Edgar Hoover. He was the FBI director, for those who don't know, for 48 years, from 1924 to 1972. So you overlapped with him in his last 5 years during that tenure. And he was known, again, for people who may not be aware, for professionalizing the FBI, but he was also widely criticized for spying on Martin Luther King Jr. and also not going hard enough against the mafia as people would have liked. So the day after Mr. Hoover died in 1972, his nemesis in the American press, Jack Anderson, released this statement. And it's pretty amazing, again, given that again, they were pretty much adversaries. Mr. Anderson wrote, when he, that is Hoover, took over the FBI 48 years ago, it was loaded with hacks, misfits, drunks, and courthouse hangers-on. In a remarkably brief time, Hoover transformed it into a close-knit, effective organization with an esprit de corps exceeding that of the Marines. So, Mr. Baker, how does that statement hold up 50 years later, knowing what we know about now about Mr. Hoover and the FBI?
Well, the statement is accurate within the framework of the time, and Hoover professionalized law enforcement in America in general. He created the National Academy and helped to raise police standards everywhere, not just in the FBI. But he did engage, it's widely documented, with abuses. Now, some of the abuses happened because they didn't have the correct guidelines. And some of them were in this intelligence, domestic intelligence, and international intelligence realm. So you had the national leadership always, whether it was President FDR, President Truman, President Eisenhower, LBJ, they'd be turning to the FBI, they'd be looking for intelligence, and the FBI really didn't have the guidelines to do things. What happened after Hoover's death, there was a lot of this was exposed, which you alluded to, and then we had in Congress the Pike Committee and the Church Committee, and they did a lot of research. Out of that came a lot of good and a lot of reform. One thing was the Congress passed the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which actually helped and protected the FBI agents. A lot of people don't even realize that because they were doing this surveillance on the foreign agents here in this country without any real guidelines. So the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA, we hear a lot about now, that set up a court, the FISA court, which allowed this legal monitoring of foreign agents in this country for intelligence purposes. Other reforms that came out of that period after the Church and Pike Committee were the Department of Justice and the FBI itself set up a whole series of guidelines, the Attorney General guidelines, as to how these investigations were to be conducted. Now, that all went into effect, the FISA Act, in 1978. So for almost 20 years, certainly for 40 years, all the abuses of, or people would point to abuses of the Hoover time, was behind us. We had the FISA Act. We acted within certain frameworks. I think what we need today now is another, and maybe we'll get it, another church committee or something similar to look at how things have gone off the track and correct them.
Do you trust the officials in charge right now to lead such a committee responsibly?
I think we have to get the message through to them. Congress is one tool to get it through to them, but it has to be done. I mean, anybody looking at this, they can't just keep saying, well, it's a few bad apples. They have to look at what fundamental changes need to be made.
How do you think Mr. Hoover matches up with the most recent FBI directors, Christopher Wray, James Comey, and Robert Mueller?
Well, it's two different worlds. It's two different eras. I can't imagine, nor can anybody else, that any one person would be the director for nearly 50 years. That created a problem into itself. I think everybody would acknowledge that. They were completely different personalities. Hoover was totally devoted to the FBI. That was his life. I think any of these other men, they had achieved earlier in their career some degree of prominence in the legal fields. And in the case of Mueller and Comey, have gone on to do other things afterwards, and Wray will too.
I have a few other names that I'd like to get your reaction on, and I'd like to ask if you'd be willing to give a few sentences of your impressions of these individuals. The first one I want to ask you about is Clyde Tolson, who is J. Edgar Hoover's second in command during his tenure. What's your opinion of him?
Well, I don't have a well-formed or stronger opinion. Most of anything I know about him is what I've read in books and newspapers. He was the long-serving number two. He was the fall guy for Hoover, and as soon as Hoover died, he resigned, and I think he died months later himself.
What about Deke DeLoach, who was the third in command of the FBI under Hoover, and he was famously involved with getting permission from Attorney General Robert Kennedy for being able to wiretap Martin Luther King?
Deke DeLoach is a little more into the modern times, actually, in his style and substance. He did work under Hoover. He retired from the FBI when Hoover was still alive, and he went on to be an executive with PepsiCo Company for years. I actually met him in his second career several times. He's a very accomplished individual. He's very smooth. He had liaison with the White House, no matter who was in the White House, for years for the FBI. I think he might characterize him as a transitional figure between the old and the new.
Mm-hmm. The next person is Mark Felt, who was the career FBI agent, deputy director of the FBI when Hoover died. And I know that he wanted to become the permanent director of the FBI, but he was passed over for L. Patrick Gray. And he famously was a source for the Watergate scandals. He confirmed a lot of what was going on there. What is your opinion of Mr. Felt? And do you think that he was a source for Bob Woodward because he was angry that he was passed over as head of the FBI?
Well, I think that's what a lot of people say. I think a lot of other people give him credit that he was a patriot, a conscientious, and he saw what was wrong, and that Gray and with his liaison to James Dean, John Dean, was passing over copies of the agents' FD-302s of the ongoing investigation of Watergate. So his motivation might have been his own personal jealousy or career ambitions, but his motivation also, we still have to open the door for the possibility that he just wanted to see the right thing done, and he thought, apparently, that the only way to do it was cooperating with the press. Other people say, well, he shouldn't have done that. He should have stood up on his own two feet and not gone through the back door of being a cooperator for Woodward and Bernstein. So there's a divided history about him. I didn't know him at all, of course, but that's, you know, that based on everything I've read.
What about L. Patrick Gray? Did you know him?
No, I didn't know him either. But I'll say this about him. I think he was a man who was misled. He came in. He really didn't have a lot of experience in the civilian government. He had been in career Navy, which you may know, and he was a submarine commander, and had gotten a degree and went to work for Richard Nixon. And then he was, you know, a straight arrow, so type. And so when Hoover was dead, they put him forward to be the next director, although he was never confirmed. They never even completed his hearing. So for that crucial 6 or 9 months after Hoover's death and when the Watergate investigation was ongoing, he was in charge. He had, and I think this is widely acknowledged, he had misplaced loyalties. In other words, he was loyal to the country, to the government, to the Constitution, but he was also very loyal to Richard Nixon and his staff. And he was misled by Dean and one or two of the others, Ehrlichman and Haldeman, around the president, what was expected of him. So he was furnishing them, and the Bureau didn't, the FBI didn't know about this for a long time. As the investigation was going on, he was giving Dean for the White House, as White House counsel, and he thought it was appropriate, apparently, copies of the agents' investigation, this team of about 14 agents out of Washington field office who were really doing most of the legwork on the Watergate investigation. He was giving the results of their investigation to the White House. This was not known within the FBI for a long time. And even later, when there were leaks, he would call them in and castigate them. Who's the leaker? And of course, what he didn't even realize, and they didn't realize, that he was the biggest leaker there was. So he was a man who started off with sterling ideas and just was misled by his own misplaced loyalties.
It's very interesting to hear about these people, because you realize that, you know, corruption or mishandling of situations is not a new thing. But what does make this moment new, you know, to your point, and as you very eloquently express in the book, is, and as you just did, is this disregard of our fundamental principles. What about Louis Free, the FBI director under Clinton?
Louis Free, and I'll begin this by saying, I consider him a friend.
Oh.
He's a very hardworking individual. He's a very conscientious man. He set very strict standards. He was very unique in the fact that he himself had been an FBI agent, a working FBI agent, and handled some very complicated cases as a very young man in New York, the well-known organized crime cases, the Pizza Connection case and the Commission case, as it's called. And then because of that, he was given the opportunity to become an assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York, and he in turn prosecuted some of these same cases because they were so complicated. Later, he was appointed, and it was considered a nonpartisan appointment. He was appointed by President George H.W. Bush as a federal district judge, and he sat on the bench in the Southern District of New York as a federal district judge. And it was only when President Clinton had a hard time finding someone to be director after William Sessions left. You might remember this period when President Bill Clinton was initially president. He ran into a few bumps in the road with several of his appointments, the appointment for attorney general, the appointment for FBI director. He went to two or three federal judges, and it turns out, and everybody talks about Nannygate. They all had problems with their nannies. They had domestic help nannies who they were not taking out their Social Security, and this became a big deal at the time. So he was running into all these problems, and he finally turned, and somebody suggested to him that he look at Louis Freeh. And he looked at Louis Freeh, and he said, my God, this is the guy, because he's been an agent, he's been a prosecutor, he's been a judge. So it was Bill Clinton who appointed Louis Freeh director. Well, Louis Freeh becomes the director, and why I say he's a man of outstanding character, all of a sudden the FBI has two or three investigations, which the president, Clinton, is involved in, and you've heard about all of these and things with him and his wife. So Louis Freeh made it a point never to be alone with President Bill Clinton, and that's I have several paragraphs in the book about that and how he avoided being alone with the president. He didn't want to be put in an awkward position. Mm-hmm. Louis Freeh's a man of incredible character, and he said to us agents, and I worked for him, about the bright line. He said, you just don't cross this bright line into bad behavior. He was very clear about that.
Thank you for these assessments. You know, you can Google these people, but you are in the position uniquely of in some cases, knowing these individuals personally and can give a great, again, assessment on them. We're almost out of time, unfortunately, with this interview, but I want to close by asking you, what are some lessons that you learned during your tenure working at the FBI? I know the question may come off as a bit trite, but I can imagine that you learned so much about our country, about human nature, about a lot of things in life. Can you share some of those takeaways with us?
I do, and I go back and forth in the book on these. The first I learned very early on that I was, and it's probably obvious, I was attracted to law enforcement because of my family background. I was very idealistic. And probably foolishly or naively so, I ran into people in law enforcement initially who were not motivated by the right ideals. That was the first eye-opener to me. Then I saw mistakes I made myself. One I recount, and it's keys off the Martin Luther King incident. I saw an FBI agent in that Ku Klux Klan march. We were covering punch a Klansman. And I thought in the back of my mind, and I didn't say anything at the time, that he had assaulted this Klansman, because I knew that these old-time agents down south had been working against the Klan for years, and there was a lot of bad blood there. The agent, his story was that the Klan, he had approached the Klansman, asked a question, the guy threw a punch at him, he blocked it, and then punched him. Later, at the end of when the Think case went to trial, it turns out somebody filmed the thing, and there it was, just as the agent related. The Klansman had thrown the first punch. And I learned then I have to be very careful in making judgments about people, because even your own eyes can deceive you. I didn't see what I thought I saw. That was a big lesson, too.
You really do not pull any punches in your book, and you're very generous with the amount of detail that you give about the FBI. What I wish I had asked Andrew Bustamante this question about, you know, because he has come out exposing some of the corruption in the CIA. What is your standing, I guess, in the FBI community? Do people view you favorably? Do they view you as a whistleblower? Have some of your relationships been damaged as a result of being so public about your assessments?
All of the above. But I will say this, and I have to keep reminding myself of this. I have one or two people, detractors, who are really former buddies of McCabe and Comey and Strzok, who have taken shots at me, so to speak, online and elsewhere, and question me. But at the same time, I've gotten, through phone calls, emails, and personal contact, many, many more. I mean, tens and tens and tens of complimentary things and people coming forward, people currently in the FBI as well as in the retired agent community, thanking me for doing this and thanking me for writing this book.
Well, I would like to thank you because the American people deserve to know what is going on with our federal agencies. As a reminder to everyone, the book is The Fall of the FBI, How a Once Great Agency Became a Threat to Democracy. Tom, thank you so much for coming on. It's been an honor to speak with you.
Well, thank you, Julie. Thank you very much.
And thank you for your service to our country.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us today. I hope that you enjoyed that. And remember, each of our thoughts, choices, and actions shape who we are. So let's think clearly, choose wisely, and act with principle and determination. See you soon. Take care.
Star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never before seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to salemnow.com. Salemnow.com.